Mackenzie,
Lamar,
I've got some bad news.
Oh God, what?
I think I watched the wrong movie. I know that we are, you know, in honor of Juneteenth, we're doing Black filmmakers, Black directors. I could have sworn you said, "Do the white thing." And that's the one I watched. And it was just, there wasn't even really a plot. It was just a bunch of people hiking and having brunch. So I'm a little worried about how well I'm going to do on today's pod.
Yeah, that's just white people, white peopling. I don't think you're ready. I don't think you're ready.
I was like, why did she want me to watch this? It's like a 2-star film. It's not engaging or funny at all.
Get it together. Well, hello, folks. Welcome back to We Drink and We Watch Things. I'm Mackenzie.
I'm Lamar.
And this month, if you didn't hear at the end of our last ep, we will be featuring Black filmmakers of all kinds, actors, directors, writers, etc., in honor of the month of June and celebration of Juneteenth on June 19th. Heck yeah. We want to kick things off with a Spike Lee classic.
Spike Lee joint, they're called, actually.
I'm sorry. You're right. A Spike Lee joint, Do the Right Thing. Excellent film. Yeah. One of the classics, I think, is what I will say. But before we get into all that and talking a little bit about how we got here, what are we drinking?
Well, I know you kept it simple. So what are you drinking?
Yeah, I kept it super simple. So the mayor in this drinks Miller High Life, and all he wants is a beer the whole movie. And I was like, I'm going to make my life easy, and I will be having a Miller today. And, of course, are we drinking We Watch Things koozies? For sale now, $200 a pop.
We have not once ever lowered the price.
We refuse. They are invaluable.
Yeah. I went with a cocktail that I kind of pulled from cocktails on Reddit, but I also switched it up a little bit. So this has gin, Di Serono, Aperol, lemon juice, and grenadine. And we're going to call this Mr. Senior Love Daddy because it's like bright pink red. Got a little lemon peel in there. It's pretty tasty.
Oh my God. I love it. I love the name of it, especially. I love that, like, fun fact, guys, we recorded this on the same day as another one. I love that your cocktails are basically the same color.
Same color.
Like, there's you always end up, your cocktails always end up being the same color.
Yeah.
Oh, I love it. Okay. Well, cheers. Here.
It's tradition.
Tradition. Cheers. Well, I'm super excited in case you couldn't tell. So we're doing Do the Right Thing. As we said, this is done in 1989. Mm-hmm. And this has an 8 out of 10 rating on IMDb, which is actually higher than I expected, not because of the quality of the film. I just was surprised.
You know how people on IMDb can be.
Yeah. And then Rotten Tomatoes, 92% for critics, 89% for audiences, which I think is really good.
I also think that people who would like not like this movie probably just didn't even bother seeing it.
Didn't even waste their time. Yeah. Or, you know, they're the 11%ers who bothered with their time on that number, I guess. But yeah, so before we get into all the basics, like we said last time, we're going to be going faster through the basics to spare you all our little diatribes on individual actors and directors, etc.
We would be here for hours if we did that today.
I know, because this cast is insane. Yeah. We're going to blow through this cast in the interest of time. But we did want to take a second and talk about this film, how we got to this theme, and kind of like how we're coming at it. So I think you said it best, Lamar, so I'll let you take it away. But give them our thoughts on how we got here.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I probably should have just written this out, but I'm just going to speak from the heart. So every June, in honor of Juneteenth, those of us who are not Black and have not lived those experiences are told, you know, sort of ways to educate yourself, ways to celebrate appropriately. And a lot of that is buying from Black businesses and taking in Black media. So this was Mackenzie's idea, and we are not going to be here on soapboxes talking about experiences that neither of us have lived. You know, we are both Hispanic, but we are both primarily white race. So we're not going to do that. We're here to give our own perspective on the cinema that we are watching. So Do the Right Thing obviously tackles some very heavy issues, but we are just going to give the perspective of two people that sat through this movie. Might get a little social, a little political, but in no way are we trying to speak on behalf of Spike Lee or anybody else who loves this or relates to this film, but it's got a message worth discussing. And I'm just going to repeat what I said last week. Please watch this film. It is just, it's crazy how relevant it still is 25 years later.
100%. No, well said. And I think, you know, the idea is with watching any film, especially, is to come at it and to ingest it from your perspective. That's all you can do, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's what we're going to do. We're going to talk about it from our perspective. We obviously have opinions on it, just like every other film that we have discussed. So we're not going to withhold those. And I think we're going to be really honest about it the way that the film is, which is what I think is the big takeaway, like you said, to the point of relevancy today. It is really honest about, you know, social dividing lines in our country. And I think they're incredibly poignant to us now and unfortunately then as well. So I think we want to, like we said, just go through the basics and get into the nitty gritty, because there's a lot to talk about in a short period of time.
Dude, I took more notes on this movie than
I know
I have in months. Like I try to keep my notes pages to a page. I went two full pages this film.
Ugh. It's so good. It's so good. All right. So again, blowing through this, bear with us. The basics are, this is written and directed by Mr. Spike Lee, who is obviously a genius, has done some incredible work. Some of the things that people probably know him for, if you do not know all of his work, are things like Malcolm X. Black Klansman is the more recent one that people might know. He got Game.
The really bad Old Boy remake.
Really bad Old Boy man.
When you say genius, he's done some shit too, just for the record.
Yeah.
He's not perfect.
He's also done a bunch of early music videos. Was like how he started. A lot of black artists.
And you in this too. It feels parts of it feel like a music video. Yeah.
For sure. He did like Prince and Tracy Chapman and a bunch of that. So he's done some really cool stuff. He also did She's Gotta Have It, which was just remade on Netflix, if you are interested. And Defy Bloods and Inside Man are other big ones that I think he's known for as well. So really quite a range, works with a lot of other black filmmakers and actors as well, but has again varied that out as well and had quite a range across his work.
And
so,
him being 32 when he directed,
wild,
is bonkers. I think at 32 I was still figuring out my shit. Like I think I had just learned how to cook spaghetti. The fact that he made this film at 32 and does, I mean, I'm going to get into like just how much respect I have. And as I said, I don't love all Spike Lee's films, but this one in particular, he blew me away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and I don't think you have to like all of his work to respect the filmmaking either. Mm-hmm. The filmmaking of this film is really well done. And again, to your point, when he's quite young and also starring in the film, which is always hard when you are in it and directing it, it's very hard to maintain the separation of that lens, I think. And you hear directors talk about that. You hear people critique that. And I don't think that shows at all in this. He does. You feel like it has this very specific perspective throughout, and it is not centered on his character in any way, right? It is even across all of the stories being told here, and I think it's very well done. So yeah,
he also, I mean, you mentioned the multiple roles of his in this. He produced it too, and I think that part of that is, I don't want to say like a control freak, but it feels like he almost has to go to bat for his own art, you know, early in his career like this, of like, he's going to these studios and trying to get financing for what's going to be a very controversial film. And multiple times they're telling him, oh, you got to change this. And he's like, nope, I'll just go find money elsewhere. So I think he trusts himself to sort of defend the art more than he might trust a third party.
Because I think he has such a clear vision, and that is so clear in this film as well, of just like, he knows what the story is. He knows how it needs to be told. And I think it's very clarifying for one person rather than so many hands in the cookie jar. Like, I think this is a very hard story to tell with too many hands in the cookie jar. You know what I mean? So I think it's totally the way to go for him to retain control, because then you get this great experience. So anyway, all that to say, we're going to go through some quick cast members, starting with Danny Aiello, who plays Sal, and he's been in a bunch of stuff. I'm sure you've seen him, maybe not recognized him every time, but he's done a ton of stuff. He was in Leon the Professional, Moonstruck, a couple of the Godfathers, Hudson Hawk. So he's done a lot, and he plays similar people, but not exactly this guy. And I think there's a lot of interesting things about Sal in this movie that we'll talk about. So
yeah,
really
I wanted to, I was going to point out that, you know, he passed about 5 years ago. So rest in peace. But I feel like that's with a movie that's from 1989, as I wrote that down, but then I was looking through and I'm like, oh wow, there are, we're going to have to say this for multiple people. So I didn't want to, like, you know, call it out every time, but
yeah, we several of these folks are no longer with us. Yeah. That is definitely true.
May they all rest in peace.
May they all rest in peace. Yeah. We have Ossie Davis, who plays Dumb Mayor, who I fucking love. He does a brilliant job. He's only in a couple things that I think people would recognize, like Grumpy Old Men, The Client. But he's been in a lot of TV and other, like, smaller independent films as well. He's also playing alongside his wife, Miss Ruby Dee, who plays Mother Sister. And she's been in a few things as well that I think are really big, but not as many that people would know. But a couple of the big ones are American Gangster, and she plays Denzel Washington's mom in that, if you haven't seen it. Jungle Fever and A Raisin in the Sun. A lot of really, really great work there.
Yeah, and you called out the marriage, and I think that their chemistry, and this is I didn't read that until after I'd seen the movie, but I was like, wow, they play off each other really well. And they have, like, this weird dysfunctional relationship in the movie, but then you find out they're actually married, and it makes a lot of sense.
And you're like, there it is. I get it now. Yeah, it's really cute. They have such a cute, fun relationship in this. Richard Edson plays Vito, who is the younger of Sal's sons, and he's hasn't done a lot. He's done, like, a lot of TV stuff and, like, smaller bit parts, but you probably know him from Ferris Bueller's Day Off, where he plays the valet who steals Ferris's car for the joyride. That is him, in case you were curious. Giancarlo Esposito, brilliant actor. He has done so much. He is in Buggin' Out. He's Buggin' Out in this one, sorry. And he's been in a million things, all wildly different. Mm-hmm. The Usual Suspects, Breaking Bad, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the more recent one, Westworld, Mandalorian. So, like, just a million different things. And
even knowing that it's him in this, though, maybe it's the glasses, because they're kind of like Coke bottle glass. I still can't, after 2 hours of this movie, I still could not see Gus from Breaking Bad as this same guy. They do not look like the same person to me.
He looks so different. And I, you know, and I love him. It's like when I first saw him, I think, and recognized him was in the Alamo Drafthouse, like, commercial about not talking in the theater. Yeah. And it's him, like, making fun of people talking in the theater, but he's talking the whole time. Anyway. Love him. He's a classic. And then, of course, we have Spike Lee, who's playing Mookie. Bill Nunn, who plays Radio Raheem, who you might know from Sister Act. That's where I immediately picture him from, is Sister Act. And then he's also in Spider-Man, Regarding Henry, New Jack City, a bunch of things like that. We have John Turturro, who plays Pino, the elder son of Sal. He's been in... It feels like more than this. I was trying to remember what I've seen him in recently, but some of the big ones are Barton Fink, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Mm-hmm. Gloria Bell is a recent one, but not the one I was thinking of. It's going to come to me someday.
The Night Of, the TV series. He was great in that. It's like an HBO miniseries. He's really good.
Maybe that was it. Yeah. Maybe that was it. Yeah. And he's in a bunch of TV. So yeah, a lot of TV. He plays a lot of interesting characters in all those different ones.
He's also in a really silly poker movie called Rounders with Matt Damon and Edward.
Oh, yes, that's what I was thinking of, because I just I just watched Rounders recently. Yeah. You're right. Yeah, that's what it is. Rosie Perez, who plays Tina, and she's in White Men Can't Jump, which is a really fun one if you've never seen it. Untamed Heart, which is a big one, and I think she was also in 21 Jump Street, like the original, the OG.
Apparently she got the job for this at like a nightclub. Spike Lee was there and insinuated, like, depending on whose story you believe, there's some sort of dance contest, and depending on if you believe Spike's story or Rosie's story, it's more or less sexist and, like, sort of demeaning of women. But either way, they're on good terms now. But that's how she got this job, was she was in the contest, but then got up on a speaker and was causing a scene. And then the security came to pull her down, and Spike Lee was standing there and heard her voice. And she has that very distinct Rosie Perez voice. And he went, yep, she's got to be in the movie. And then she, of course, has the big opening dance.
I was going to say, and not even that, she opens the movie with quite a dance sequence herself. So, yeah, it's like, I timed it. It's like 5 minutes. Yeah. But yeah, she opens the whole shebang. Then we have Mr. Martin Lawrence, who does not have a big role here, but also it's worth noting that none of these people have a big role. They all have, we have a couple of strong leads, and then we've got these, this mix of this community where they all almost have kind of an even share. And she, and he's one of those as well. He plays C, but he's in Bad Boys, as we know.
Yeah, this
he
also was his own first film role. And then he had his own TV show after this. But
I was going to say, his TV show is, I think, what I first knew him for, which was Martin. And then he's in Blue Streak and, you know, some stuff like that. So, and we also have, of course, Mr. Samuel L. Jackson. We cannot omit one of his gazillion movies that he's in, but he's Mr. Senior Love Daddy. I love that they say senior, by the way. That's how they pronounce it.
A little redundant too, Mr. Senior, but okay.
Yeah.
You do, and you, Sam.
And then we've got Roger Guinevere Smith, who plays Smiley. And he's also in He Got Game, another Spike Lee film, and then Summer of Sam, which are like his big things. But I think his character is important, so I wanted to call him out.
Yeah, I, with all the characters that you just listed, and especially with the Sam Jackson character, the thing that stands out to me first about this movie, before we even get into everything, is just this feels like a neighborhood. It feels like a city block. It's all shot on one block in New York City, but just the cast of characters, like you said, it's not as though they focus. It feels like a bunch of vignettes of these people who share the street. Occasionally they interact with each other, but it feels like a bunch of strung together moments that you would see any given day on the street. And I think Sam Jackson is this weird through line in the film of this observer who's, you know, conveniently located and with a window right there seeing everything, but also is kind of narrating the action, providing the soundtrack to the action. And I really liked that vibe. Like, it feels like New York City.
Yeah, and I think that's the point, right? Like, I think that's part of the point, and we'll get into it. But I mean, it is meant to feel like a genuine community. These are people who know each other, have known each other, grew up around each other, live together every day in Brooklyn. And it feels very true to life. And it also feels like an homage to a lot of plays and films that operated this way in like the 20s and 30s and 40s of this, all these things and the actions take place in these real communities. And that comes through. That super comes through. And that's why we have so many characters here, because they are all interacting with each other on a very normal, regular, day-to-day basis, the way you would in a small city couple blocks like this. So it makes a lot of sense. But we'll do a super quick summary, which again is an IMDb summary that does not do the complication of this film justice, but it'll give us the highlights, which are: on the hottest day of the year, on a street in the Bedford-Stuyvesant section of Brooklyn, everyone's hate and bigotry smolders and builds until it explodes into violence, which, again, succinct but accurate.
Yeah, that's exactly how I would describe this. I love that that is the exact way it plays out, of just as this film goes on, the day is getting hotter and hotter, and you see more sweat on people's faces, and you see that they're getting more irritable, and there's these chippy moments throughout from the start of uncomfortable moments and this unease that happens in the neighborhood between people of different races. And this is what I like about this is not just black and white. There's a family of Koreans, I believe we're told, and other people involved as well, which again, it feels like New York, right? There's this diversity and we're very proud of that, but it also leads to this underlying tension. But I love how that temperature builds and builds and builds, and eventually by the end everyone's emotions are boiling along with just the environment.
Yeah, like it says, it just builds and smolders, and you can feel it and see it throughout. So yeah, some quick production notes before we get going. It was pretty successful despite the really difficult topic and complicated feelings about the ending. So it had a $6.2 million budget, and it did 37.3 in the box office. So pretty solid performance, I would say, in return. And again, probably one of the reasons that Spike Lee continued to be trusted to own and control and do so much more work like this in the future. So it was also nominated for Best Supporting Actor for Danny, who played Sal. And it was nominated for Best Screenplay as well. And that, again, Spike Lee original screenplay as well. And so I think you feel like the quality of this film, it's not surprising at all that it was nominated for something a couple of times. It's not also not terribly surprising that it didn't win in that time period as well, for all the complication and almost controversy around it when it came out. I did quite a bit of research, and there were many, many reviews that accused this film of wanting to incite racial violence, which is some bullshit, I'll say right at the top.
Did you see Spike Lee's response to that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and he still gets asked about it to this day. Yeah. You know, he's like, it's not about inciting racial violence. Like, you're missing the point of the film. Mm-hmm. And there are multiple critics, by the way, who addressed that as well, who said he lauded Roger Ebert's analysis, who did a couple of analyses of this film, actually. And he's like, anybody who thinks that this is about inciting racial violence wasn't watching, wasn't paying attention.
Right.
You know, right. That's not the point. This is an honest look of what can happen and has happened in our communities in America. And this is just one neighborhood that is representative of that. So
and continues to happen.
And continues to happen.
I read a different quote of his where, and this was a little cattier, I guess, but where he said, well, if white people can see an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie and not go out and like shoot a bunch of people,
yeah,
you know, then I should be able to make this film about and not be afraid.
Then black people can go to a movie and not go, set cars on fire. Like, that's bullshit,
right.
You know? And it's again, that criticism itself is rooted in racism to mm-hmm. assume that the black community can't go watch this film.
Piece of fiction. Yeah.
A piece of fiction and not come out of it rioting. That's mm-hmm. just bullshit. So anyway, but all that to say, this is quite a bit older film. As we said, this is done in 1989. We're not going to have a spoiler free zone this time. We're going to get into the nitty gritty. So as per usual, turn around, don't drown. It's spoiler time.
Hell yeah.
So my first note at the top is the note about the dance scene that goes on for 27 years. I do think it's fun. It's so 80s, like that whole opening sequence, the title cards, the outfit, the music, the whole thing is so fucking 80s. And it's fun. It's a fun opening and it's like fun music. And it's like you feel like you're getting in the zone and all that. It's cute.
Yes.
But I do think it's a bit disjointed from literally everything else that happens, I will say.
There's a couple pieces like that. I mean, we'll get to that. If there's a few moments where the movie, that's why I said parts of this feel, you can see his music video director coming into this of these mm-hmm. cutaway pieces, and this opening credits is an example of that, where apparently they took 8 hours to film these. I wrote down Rosie Perez, you know, that day's Lady Gaga with her costume changes in this opening thing of like she's wearing 6 or 8 different outfits and just killing it, but apparently she just sweat her ass off for 8 hours filming that. And then the only other call out I had there was that I had heard that Public Enemy song probably 30 or 50 times in my life before this, and you hear mm-hmm. it constantly throughout this film. I think Radio Raheem is just always playing the same song. Like, don't you like any other records? And he's like, why do you need to know? You don't like Public Enemy, but he's always playing the same song. And I was like, why are they having him just play? I did not know that that song was written originally for this film. Like, it was mm-hmm. not an existing. So I guess it makes sense that it was like, yeah, we'll write this. You just have to feature it 6 times in your movie. But it is a great song.
It is a great song. But it does make a recurring appearance. And it becomes kind of this official or unofficial theme song to the whole mm-hmm. shebang. But I mean, when you get a new record, like, I just feel like I channel Radio Raheem because, like, I will play this shit on repeat for however long. I mean, mm-hmm. play the album over and over and over. So I'm super guilty of this. Like, no judgment. So
you were one of those people that hit the like single track repeat, not like the loop the whole album, just the one song.
I would do both. Like, I would single track repeat like 2 or 3 times, but for every single track, and then listen to the whole thing over again all the way through. Like, it was, my family probably wanted to kill me. My dad is actually just like this. My dad, the drummer musician. And so we would sit in his studio and we would do this. We would listen to things on repeat, but everyone else in our family was probably like, shut the fuck up. But that's just how we listen to music. We're like, I gotta ingest this a lot. I gotta like process this.
You were like J-Lo, Waiting for Tonight, one track, repeat, go for 2 hours.
Okay, that would not be the one, I would say, but yes, that was the general concept.
Nice.
But I love all these characters, like you said. It just right away you're hit with the neighborhood of it all, the community of it all. Everybody knows each other. You open up with Mookie, you know, and he's making fun of his sister who he's mooching off a little bit. Mm-hmm. Mookie the Mooch, I feel like should have been his nickname.
Moochie.
But he's mooching off his sister, and you can feel the heat from the beginning of the film. Like you said, there are these strong themes. There's these themes of community. Mm-hmm. There's these themes of the heat, the boiling over of it all. And they talk about the heat amongst themselves, but it's also in the news. It's on the radio. It's pictured on the newspaper. It's a scorcher, like all these things. Yeah. And you just feel all of that. And it gives such texture to the film, I think, right away. You can feel the heat. You can feel the dynamic. You can see people that remind you of people in your neighborhood, remind mm-hmm. you of people you've seen. You know what I mean? It just gives so much color and context that I think lays this amazing groundwork for the rest of the film.
I completely agree. That first 3 or 4 minutes, talk about setting a tone of,
yeah,
you come out of that opening credits where you're like, okay, I just watched 4.5 minutes of Rosie Perez dancing to Fight the Power. We mm-hmm. come back and then it's like, okay, we open up with Sam Jackson's DJ sort of giving, we get a shot of DeMayer waking up, we get Mookie mm-hmm. waking up, we go outside, we meet these characters, we see Sal and them opening the store. Like I said, it's a series of vignettes of all these random interactions where sometimes they're by themselves doing their own things. It feels real. It feels like yeah. a day. You're not always going to be tracking the same person. You're not mm-hmm. going to have these people sharing the same location for extended periods of time. It just feels like what would actually happen.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it, like you said, it, you feel the, what would actually happen of it all, the community of it all, like that this could be a normal day. And I think that's, mm-hmm. I think that's literally the point of this, right? The point of this is that this can happen. Yes. All of this can happen any day, anytime, because of this thing that's bubbling under the surface every day of your lives, which is this racial and community tension yeah. between all these different communities, the Hispanic community, the Black community, the white community, the Italian community, who they feel is white, right? The Korean mm-hmm. community and the cops, which cannot be overlooked, right? There are yeah. all these different small groups that have varying degrees of tension with one another and share the same space. Yeah, so it can happen anytime.
I wrote down at some point, I mean, we'll get to the ending later, but I wrote down that this kind of, for the first 80 to 100 minutes, like really feels like a comedy. Like there's some
yeah.
difficult scenes, but it feels like it's mostly just kind of like making light of some of these issues. And obviously it doesn't end that way, but to your point of it just feeling like a normal day, it's like, oh, there's this zany cast of characters and they're poking mm-hmm. fun at each other. And yeah, it's kind of hateful, but it's also kind of silly the way that they're going about it. And they're having some very heartfelt conversations around it, which I appreciate. I think that it would be very easy for Spike Lee as a Black man to say, oh, I'm writing this film, and all those times in the past when white people have poorly written Black people, it would be very easy for him to be like, I'm going to make this the most, you know, stereotypical Italian character or whatever mm-hmm. he wanted to do. But instead, it's like, they feel real, like this feels like an Italian family.
Right.
And like the conversations that all these characters are having, just there is a sense of legitimacy of just, yeah, like you said, normalcy to it, which is scary in a way.
It is scary. That's yeah. literally the point, is like, I think you called out a few things that I want to touch on, which is that all these characters have nuance to them, mm-hmm. right? They're all normal people. And I think this is part of, I think it was Roger Ebert's critique or even some of Spike Lee's commentary, but the crux of it is like, no person, you, myself, anyone, is all one thing. They're not mm-hmm. all good, all bad. They're not completely anti-racist, and they're not completely racist necessarily. I mean, there are definitely people who are completely racist, but you know what I mean? Like, nobody is one extreme or the other. There are facets to them, and most people fall into some degree of moderation of like, they have things that they do wrong and they have things mm-hmm. that they do right. And I think that that's, so many of these characters illustrate that so well, of just the humanness of it all, that these are people who are not perfect, but are genuinely who they are. And it feels honest. It feels like an honest portrayal of these people.
Yeah. And everyone's a product of their experiences too. It's like,
right,
you understand why some people resent others, but then you have other people who haven't gone through those. And you have people trying to, I love that nuance of people, you know, characters talking to people they trust, and it happens on with every group in this, essentially, of like a character who is sort of whatever term you want to use, misinformed, ignorant, whatever it might be, being given some guidance from somebody they trust of like, why do you feel that way? Like, why are you carrying yeah. this with you? I love those conversations too.
And they do. They have these great conversations. But then to your point earlier, they also say a lot of things that are a mixed bag, right?
Right.
It's there's some racist shit. There's some just inconsiderate shit. There's just like being dicks to people as people kind of stuff. And then there's these moments of kindness and genuine affection for one another and appreciation for one another. And I think that's one, an important part of the nuance, but another reason why it's building. Right? Because these microaggressions, as we call them now, but wouldn't have then, these microaggressions build and they add up over time. And somebody saying one racist thing that you can let slide, and then they say one racist thing a couple days later or the next day or the next day. And I think what's great about this film is that it shows it all in one day, but this has probably happened this exact same way every day.
Yep.
Every single fucking day. And so this is the day it boils over, because you've called me an azupepe, which is Italian for black pepper, which is racist, every day, and you think it's a joke, right? And it's not funny anymore, right? It's building into not being funny. And I think to your point, that's why it feels like a comedy at the top of this is funny and this is silly and we're shooting the shit with our friends. But then it bleeds into this thing that blows up because it has been building and it's not funny anymore, you know?
Yeah. And it's even our, you know, who I would consider our protagonists, Mookie and Sal, who I think throughout the film are probably the most likable of the main group, I guess, you know, even they have these underlying subtle things that you notice of like, okay, but again, it feels real. And then by the end, things are coming out of Sal's mouth where it's like, wait, 30 minutes ago, you were telling your son to feel this way, but he's pushed to this point and these things that he's got in his heart come out. And it's just like, people, we are complex, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's like,
and I think you hit it right there. Yeah. I think you hit it right there. He's pushed. Right. Mm-hmm. At his best, at his baseline of who he wants to be, is a guy who loves and accepts everyone in this community and feeds them. He's very proud of his feeding the people who have grown up here. They grew up on my food, he says. Mm-hmm. And he talks about, I'm very proud of that. Like, you may not understand. He's talking to his racist ass son. You may not understand, but that's important to me. I'm proud of that. And he overall loves these kids in this community. That's his baseline. Right. But as he's pushed and they fall into their own stereotypes, or one or two of them do things that are shitty, or somebody makes fun of him or pushes back or says something racist to him or calls him Italian for the umpteenth time, then it builds for him too. Right. And then he reduces to a worse version of himself that doesn't want to say or feel these things every day, but then, to your point, is pushed and crosses the line. And they all have those moments. And Mookie's, I think, his foil as well, to your point, of they are in the same situation on quote unquote opposite sides of this is the black guy version of this same character, and this is the Italian white guy version of this same character, who are trying to be moderate, decent versions of themselves every day, and both are pushed to the brink by the end of this day.
Yeah. It's hard to watch at times. I mean, it needs to be watched, but it's difficult to see people that you think are going to be the heroes of this story just sort of reduced to that by the end.
And I think what's cool is that, to your point, it happens very naturally. Like, this feels like, this is a bummer to watch, but it has progressed in a way that feels plausible and understandable, even.
Yep.
Like, the way that it escalates, you're like, I know how we got here. I can see how this person did this thing, right? Yeah. But what one of my favorite things, you said that Mr. Senior Love Daddy is kind of narrating a lot of things, and he's kind of a thread throughout. The other person who I think is quite a threat and very different from him is DeMayer. And I love him from that. From the first opening, I was like, and I've seen this a couple of times, but I think this is maybe my third watch. But every single time I watch this, I'm like, this guy is so fucking adorable and wonderful and cute and sweet and minded his own business, as he says himself multiple times. And he's not bothering anybody. That's not bullshit. He just moves through the day and he leaves everybody alone. He just lives his life.
And honestly, that's like the dream, right? I'm retired.
I'm fucking retired.
I'm just going to drink beer every day. Leave me the fuck alone. Like, what's wrong with that? That's the American dream.
That whole my whole thing in my note is like, he's not bothering anybody. What are you guys' problem? Like, leave him alone. And he says that. But what I love about him is that he says so many things that are so wise. He's this thread throughout who is easily dismissed as the old, retired, senile, stupid guy, whatever they want to call him or assume him to be. But the things that come out of his mouth are kind and profound and harmless. Yeah. Like, they promote peace and tranquility in this community, and they also don't escalate things. That he was himself attacked verbally multiple points in this movie, and he just doesn't engage. Yeah. And like, you look at him and you see him going like, you know, that's that wisdom of age of like, that's not worth my time. Like, I'm not getting into that. These young kids are being silly and stupid. They're going to learn, you know?
Yeah.
And I love that from him. Every time he spoke the whole film, I'm just like, I just want more of him. He's so precious.
I love when mother sister's yelling down at him. And he says, what did I ever do to you? Or what did I ever do wrong? And she goes, being a drunk fool. And he goes, well, besides that,
I have that note too.
There's nothing wrong with that, you know?
I love his response too. Again, he will very clearly and calmly defend himself too. That's the other thing. Like, he doesn't pick a fight, but he will with everyone. He will clearly and calmly defend himself. He does it to the kids making fun of him later. He does it to her. He's like, besides that, like, I get to do this. I am not bothering nobody. Like, he says, I don't bother nobody. Leave me alone, you know? And I love that he ends all of it every time with some sort of positivity, like even to mother sister who doesn't want to like him. I love this quote. He's like, one day you're going to be nice to me. We may both be dead and buried, but you're going to be nice, or at least civil. And I just thought, that's so cute. He's just like, you're going to love me at some point. You're just gonna.
Not make one of those inspirational quote a day calendar, like tear off calendars with Demare's lines.
Yes.
Likely you're missing out on some merchandising opportunities.
Oh.
But I love his commitment to Miller High Life. You know, as you said, you're drinking it, but he ends up going with a Miller Lite, and it's like, oh, this was back when light beer was sort of a bad thing to people.
It's
like everybody drinks light beer, but yeah, it blows my mind that he was just so dead set on Miller High Life.
I just love that he screams at them for trying to make him change the beer. He's like, you make a change, man changes beer after however many years, he says. You're asking a lot. You are asking a lot. Like, I just love that. But that's one of those moments of tension too. And he's nice and he's not fighting with them per se.
Right.
But you can tell the Korean family in the community is arguably the least accepted person. Like, almost everyone is agreed upon that they don't like the Koreans, which is another problem in and of itself, which, again, still relevant today.
Yeah, it's rough to watch all those different interactions throughout this, where a lot of them, too, start out harmless. But then by the time you get to the end of the movie, like you keep saying, it's like you realize what was actually happening in those situations. But before we get into the heavy stuff, I really want to touch on like why there are some great comedic moments, and this is so well written. And I really like when they do the fire hydrant and they're
they bust
spraying
it open.
Water everywhere, and then you get an appearance from, let me get the name right, Frank Vincent, who would end up going on. I mean, he's been in like every mobster movie ever.
Yeah.
You know, he's in Goodfellas.
He's always mob guy number three or whatever. But
he was one of the main, I guess, antagonists in The Sopranos. But he gets his antique car like soaked out from the water, and then the cops come. And there again, it's like hard to talk about this now because you know eventually the cop thing escalates. But this situation really made me laugh of them trying to get his story of what happened. And they're like asking him questions, but he doesn't know. And he's like, why would I know their names? I don't know what their names are. I don't live here. And they say, well, we can't do any. What are their? And he says, Mo and Joe. I don't know. And he goes, oh, and the cop writes it down like really deadpan, like, okay, Mo and Joe, do they have a last name? And he's like, Black? And he's like, they're brothers? That got me really good.
I liked it. I think it's funny, but it's also, to your point, it's one of those jokes that like,
being offensive. Absolutely.
He's being offensive.
But I like that the cop is taking it as like, I think the cop is probably just fed up, but the cop is, he's taking it verbatim. And that's what makes it
funny. But I think the cop is like, just like you said, he's just taking the report to fucking say like, I took the report. Because then at the end of it, he's like, yeah, I'd get out of your, he says something else racist where he's like, I'd get in your car and go before these people strip it down.
Yeah.
And I was like, this fucking guy. And they have these funny lines, to your point, that are interspersed between these like really racist things. And it's like, it's this moment of levity that you kind of need to be able to keep watching this. You know what I mean?
But he doesn't give you long to enjoy it, Spike.
Yeah, you don't get long before somebody has peppered in something else also terrible. Like, and the other ones being like, they say racist things about the Italians, racist things about the Koreans, racist things about Hispanics. I think they even say racist things about the Jews at multiple points, mm-hmm. all these kinds of things. Then they say the R word about Smiley, mm-hmm. like, you know, and just all these things that are not okay, but they're peppered and they're paced in between these other, to your point, like funny things. And speaking of really funny lines, I love the little corner group of guys, the three dudes on the corner.
Yes. Yeah.
They're such gems. They have this great running commentary. They talk about everything and they talk about it slow. You know, nobody's in a rush to have these conversations or deep dive on these conversations, but they're like talking shit to each other. They're talking shit about everyone. They're, yeah. you know, they're the ones spilling the tea on the corner. You know what I mean? And they're hilarious in the way they balance each other and have different perspectives and just roast each other. And I love, one of my favorite lines was you're 30 cents away from having a quarter. And I was like, and I was like, that is so good. I love that. That is so funny. But yeah, they'll talk shit to each other and they'll call each other out. Yeah. Like, I loved one of them who was like, goes to get a beer at the Korean market. And he's like giving them shit for being racist about, you know, new arrivals in the neighborhood or whatever. Cause he's talking about the Koreans and he's like, how dare they come into this neighborhood? And mm-hmm. he's like, this store has been boarded up for years. What do you care? They show up and have a market, like whatever, you can get your beer there, whatever. And then he goes and is immediately racist to the Korean guys. Mm-hmm. So like he can roast them and defend this community right across the street from him. And then he's going to go over there and it's implied he won't pay. And that he will bully them and be racist to them and treat them like they're in his neighborhood to serve him and all that kind of stuff. So it's like the hypocrisy is real throughout.
Yeah. I mean, we keep saying people are complex, right? So there's two things that I really like about those three dudes on the corner. I love that, again, I said before, this feels like New York City. Like, this feels like a melting pot. And I love that each of them has a distinct accent. I'm not going to guess on what they are, but it's like they have these three guys and they all have different accents. You know, mm-hmm. I love that about it. And I love that apparently most of their dialogue was improvised.
Yeah.
I'm sure they had some talking points, but wow.
Their whole scenes were improvised, was my understanding. They're just sitting on the corner shooting the shit. You know, that's the whole shtick.
I mean, props to them if that the black owned businesses conversation, if that was their idea, or I don't know if Spike Lee said, hey, have a conversation about this. Mm-hmm. But that I just thought spoke volumes of like, again, it is a complex issue. And there are people who are angry about lots of things. But they say to him, they're like, OK, you want to open a business? What kind of business are you going to open? Where's your business plan? Go ahead. Go do it. And it's like they're calling him out on his shit.
Yeah. And they do a lot of that, of like, you're talking shit about how one day you're going to be this, one day you're going to do that, you're going to, you know, all these things, but you're just sitting on this corner talking. And they're not the only ones who do it either. Like, that happens throughout. There's a lot of that with Mookie. There's a lot of implication that Mookie is kind of a shit talker, hypes himself up, says he's going to be a thing, do a thing, all this stuff. But then he's just being lazy delivering pizzas. And he's not even that great at that because he's kind of a slacker, right? He's walking around. He's not bad at it, but he's not great at it either, right? Because he's walking around the neighborhood, he's seeing his friends and he's shooting the shit and he's just slow at it, or he's stopping and taking a shower in the middle of the day, you know, whatever. But he is a good guy. Like, you don't perceive him to be a bad guy. He's a good guy, but he's a guy who's slow to do the things that he's saying that he's going to do. And like, so you kind of see that theme throughout also. And I think you see that they all kind of accept each other for who they are, but they won't, to your point, hesitate to call it out and tell you your shit, you know?
And they also, that group has, again, one of the most telling scenes in this was just, to my point earlier, you had that sort of comedic scene with the cops, which has that underlying and some straight up racism there. But until you see this random, again, it's a scene that's sort of, it doesn't feel random, you know, knowing what we know, but when it's just the slow motion scene of the cops driving past and those three guys on the corner, like the stare down, and it zooms in on his, they're just making eye contact. That is sowing the seeds of sort of the distrust of just like at any given time in this country, right? Somebody could do something crazy and it could be the police. It could be some random person on the corner, but it's just these tensions are there no matter how much at this point in the movie, we are sort of laughing at some of the comedic lines.
And I know it's this like not all cops thing or whatever that people are going to potentially hear this and try to defend or what have you, but the data is there, right? Like these communities, all of them in this region are unfairly and disproportionately targeted mm-hmm. by cops. So there is this natural skepticism, this healthy fear of these people being in the community. And you can see why, because again, in that conversation, like they said, they're like, well, you should move on before these people strip it down. Like these cops are operating in the community under the assumption that the people they are policing are criminals is the point. They have decided that that's their baseline, and that's dangerous. And I think that's an important comment here that comes up throughout. But one of the funny things I think about these cops is that no cop is that buff. That fucking guy. That is
okay. Now you're really getting us in trouble with it.
I don't give a shit. Come for me, cops. Like I have not seen a cop in I don't even know how long that has biceps like that freaking guy. That guy is Schwarzenegger in a too small top for his uniform. And I just was like, that's literally in my notes. I was like, no cops are this buff. I don't understand. But they're not all donut cops. I'm not saying that, but they're not all freaking power lifters. Like
I thought it was really funny for them to have that scene where there's the conflict with the white guy on the bike that runs over his sneakers and to have that character who's kind of like getting into it with the black people in the neighborhood. And he is a white dude wearing a Larry Bird jersey. It's just like, oh, you're wearing a white basketball player from Boston and you live in, and he's like, I was born in Brooklyn. Like, what?
But he says he's born in Brooklyn and you're like, why are you, don't get me wrong, Larry Bird, Dream Team, like I get it to some degree, but also like, why are you wearing that shirt in Brooklyn? That seems like a terrible idea, but it is also really bold of him to just run into this guy and not say, excuse me, first of all, but secondarily, he does sound sincere when he apologizes, but I would also be annoyed. I'd be like, well, you're apologizing because I called you out on it. Like you didn't consider me or, you know, apologize for running into me. But then he kind of like doubles down and defends himself against this increasingly large group of people. Yeah. And that is not a, like, I'm surrounded by black people thing for me. That is, I'm a surrounded by people thing for me. Yeah. And like, you would be intimidated regardless of who's on the other side of that. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of his like very white entitlement to not proceed with fear for me. Like that was part of that scene for me where I'm like, it doesn't matter. Again, the color of the people on the other side of this conversation, it matters that you are surrounded and you feel safe as a white guy by himself and safe enough to push back on this conversation. And I was like, that is a right that is not afforded. And that is a comfort that is not afforded to every single person in this film. He's the one and only, you know?
So I'd like to transition from that to talk about a couple other scenes that are a little more difficult. I think they're important to this film, but I also want to know where you stood on the way that Spike Lee chooses to deliver them. And the first one is that the fourth wall breaking hate speech where they cut from the conversation. I think it was Mookie and Pino were having, and they cut to these, you know, people looking directly into the camera, just screaming different slurs and obscenities at a specific group of people. And you get basically everybody, you know, they're making every race you could think of or group of people you could think of. You're getting these different people delivering these speeches. So I don't know if it's like, how did you feel about that? But like, what's the intent there in the way that Spike Lee directs that scene? Like, why have that? And how is it supposed to make you feel? Or how did it make you feel?
I mean, I would say that I think it's about showing that this is somewhat a universal experience for people on one or the other side, right? I don't mean everybody is the target of racist language or attacks, but just most people, I think, have been on one or the other side of this type of conversation, or at least witness it, right? And I think it doesn't have, it's not exclusive to the black community. It's not exclusive to the Asian American community. It's not exclusive to the Hispanic community, right? There are different slurs for every single fucking person, right? From Jews to white people even. And like, don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to like take the side of white people here, right? But I'm just saying, like, people of color and white people, there are terms, the discriminatory terms for all of us, right? And you can be on the receiving end of any of those at any time, regardless of who you are. And I think it was showing that, like, we all have preconceived notions about the other, right? Yep. Who is the person that is not us? And what do I not understand about them that creates some sense of fear and anger in me? Because that is how we as people react to fear, right? We react emotionally charged in some way. And a lot of times that comes out as anger. And so I think we villainize the other as people. Mm-hmm. And I would not consider myself to be racist. I would consider myself to be anti-racist, but I am not immune to this. Right. I am not immune to looking at a person and not thinking something shitty about them because I don't know them or I don't understand them or haven't lived their life. Right. Like, we are all guilty of that. And we just have to be honest about that. And I think this is a scene that is intended to show that, to say, like, you all do this. Everybody does this, yeah, to some degree.
I think you're spot on there. I'm pretty, like, hearing, even just as you started talking, I was like, yeah, that sounds exactly right, because it ties into what I said earlier of the way that Spike Lee wrote this. It would have been very easy to make a film, mm-hmm, where, you know, I'm going to put
heroic
it in really
black
simple,
people,
yeah,
terrible
heroic
white
black
people.
White people, yeah, are bad, cops are bad. That's, yeah, not what this is saying. This is saying everyone harbors resentment, fear, racism, all these negative emotions. And, mm-hmm, yeah, it's things that bubble up over time. And maybe we don't say those hateful slur terms outlet, but that is, I think it's very intentional that he has that directed breaking the fourth wall of, here's what it's like if somebody were to say these to you. But I think it's also helping yourself to, like, are you the type of person who might say something or have these thoughts, you know?
Or have you thought it? Exactly. Yeah. Have you thought it? And I think, like, it's a visualization of saying the quiet part out loud.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
You have these quiet moments and these quiet thoughts universally we all have that are shitty. And it's saying it out loud and making you reckon with that.
Yeah. And I like that it cuts from that to Mr. Senior Love Daddy telling everybody to chill out. And it's just, yeah, that put my nerves back at ease, because that was a very difficult scene to get through. And, yeah, then the other one that I wanted to mention, because this one I didn't take as many notes on, but anything to say here as far as the hate and love speech that Radio Raheem gives about his Nux. Like, did you take anything away from that one?
I mean, I think it's one of the many representations of there is a fine line between love and hate. Mm-hmm. And they're two sides of the same coin, one in each hand, all those kinds of analogies of and you see it, like you said, all day. There's these jokes that are, like, borderline familial and fun. And then you have these insults that are, mm-hmm, familial and not fun, right? And it's like, you have these, we tread that line lightly as people, and it can yield these beautiful moments, as are shown throughout the film, of, like, the mayor saving this little boy and explaining, yeah, that to his family. But on the flip side of that is a woman beating the shit out of her kid right there in front of him for lying and for having put himself in that situation, mm-hmm, right? So, like, we are in these succinct small moments, seeing both sides of that throughout this story. And I think that's another poignant double tap on that theme in this visual moment.
Yeah, that's a good call. I honestly don't have a ton to add there. It was one that stood out to me, and I was like, huh, I don't know if I took what I was meant to from that. So it helps having you sort of lend it some.
But I think it's fair to say from a filmmaking perspective that there are these almost hit you over the head moments like that, that, mm-hmm, take you out of the action for a second, including the screaming, you know, of the, yeah, of the racist slurs, and then the love hate moment and all of that. And I think those take you out of it for a second to kind of hit you over the head with the themes again.
Yeah.
And they don't feel as cohesive, but they do feel important, I think, like, to some degree, as far as double tapping on themes. But I could hear you that it's like, it takes you to a different place for a hot second, and it takes a second to process.
I wanted to mention, I wrote down that shortly after that moment, Mr. Senior Love Daddy, in addition to telling everyone to chill out, also takes the time to give all of us, like, an extensive list of, here's some black music artists. So for Juneteenth,
I fucking love that list.
Here you
I don't
go.
Know. I don't know if you, I mean, I'm a, like, jazz, blues, mm-hmm, rock. Like, I'm a fan. I have been for years and years. And listening to that list every time, I was like, yes, smashes. Yes, mm-hmm, incredible. Mm-hmm, yes, mm-hmm, queen. Yes, king. Like, I was, that list is a comprehensive list of black badasses in music. Like, just it is. And if you haven't heard any of them, get that snippet, listen to that snippet, and that's your to-do list, your homework of who to listen to, because it's an incredible list of artists, beautiful list of artists. I was like, oh my God, he just keeps getting better and better.
Yes. I was like, oh, I got two things in one piece of media here, because he lists 74 different music artists there. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, if for some reason, if you're not already listening to Black artists, or you want to take June and celebrate a little bit more of like taking in more Black music, that list is just not all encompassing, because it was 1989. But for the time it was made, that is like history.
But a lot of those folks are still around. Like a Wynton Marsalis is still around.
Well,
right?
I'm talking more about like the new folks who have come out since then.
No, for sure. I just mean a lot of those people are still making music. A lot of them are standards.
Mr. Senior Love Daddy is not a time traveler. So he didn't know who was going to be famous in 2006.
He did not. It's true. But, you know, some of those folks are making new music to this day. Absolutely. Not all. Of course, the Duke Ellingtons of the world, bless them, are no longer with us. But that list is just, again, it's so comprehensive. It's such an incredible list of music. Maybe we can share out some songs for y'all, because Mackenzie loves all of them. So I got lots of recs.
So before this is the last thing, I swear, because I really want to get to the craziness of how this all goes down. But the last thing I wanted to call out was, I wrote down at one point, like, where did Rosie Perez go? But I guess that is part of what makes this realistic, you know, in the neighborhood way. But I did think it was weird that she does that whole 4 or 5 minute dance scene to start. Then we get a scene, I think, of her with her mom and the kid. And then we don't see her for like an hour.
Well, it's like baby daddy, baby mama drama that is like, again, it's a little bit of a stereotype. But Mookie is kind of living that life. And you see both sides of that coin of, he's not taking good enough care, but then he does want to be there, but he does need to make money, but he also needs to prioritize his family, and that delicate balance that he's trying to deal with. That's an experience that he has as a character that is a normal, natural experience, trying to be a parent and trying to work, you know, and somebody being on the other side of that, feeling like it's not enough, it's not what I need. It does, I think, give us a good storyline, for background story for Mookie, that gives him some depth. It gives him some depth beyond, I'm just the pizza delivery guy, right? Who, yeah. You know, and so I think that's the point of it, is it's just to add to his background and to his character. And when she's there, she fills that void where you're like, okay, I see more about him. I see more to him. You see other facets of him as a person because of that relationship.
Yeah, it does kind of make sense that they wait, because he's been working all day so far and he's trying to get that money and whatnot. So it makes sense when he shows up at her place. It's like, oh, he's working for this family of his kid, his girlfriend. And there's one thing that's a little uncomfortable here, but I want to talk about it, because I think we obviously, this movie tends to spur a lot of discussions around race. But I think there's a kind of a difficult conversation around men and women in this, and that is Rosie Perez's experience on set here, because I thought it was a little strange, like him showing up there, and then they have sort of the sex scene with like the ice cubes and things, which I'm like, okay, it's different, something like, oh, it's really hot outside, let's use some ice cubes, whatever. But I thought it was strange that when there is the nude scene, her face isn't in it, and I was like, oh, maybe it's like a body double or something like that, like, no, you know, I don't care. But I was like, why have that shot? You know, it just seems strange. It seems weird. It doesn't need to be in the film. And apparently this is the messed up part. And again, they are on good terms now. But apparently Rosie Perez was really uncomfortable with the nude scene in this and didn't want to do it, to the point that she was in tears. So they opted to shoot this scene without her face in it so that you wouldn't see her crying. And she also just didn't want her face attached to what they were shooting. And I think that's really fucked up, obviously. And I'm glad that they're on good terms now, but I think that's just a recurring thing in Hollywood. And like, we've had all the Me Too and the Weinsteins of the world and all these fucked up things that have happened to actresses over the years. And I think this is just an example of that I thought was worth, you know, having some discussion around.
I mean, I think it's an unfortunate example of sometimes women are the last civil rights group to get attention.
Yeah.
And so you have these open, you know, these people of color who are an open topic in this film, and you don't get justice for the women in this film. And I don't mean the production. I mean, like, there's not a lot of conversation around how are women disproportionately affected by these racial tensions and things like that. So I think, unfortunately, it rings true to me, rings realistic to me as a woman. And I'm glad, to your point, to hear that they're on good terms now. Yeah. But that should never have happened. That should never have been an issue on this set, especially from a filmmaker who's trying to tell a story like this. And I think that's a fair criticism of you can be representative and show the humanity and the struggles of all these different communities, and you're ignoring this huge group right here. And that's not okay. I think that's a fair criticism.
Yeah. I think that for as much as I said earlier, you know, Spike Lee really, he writes different types of people well. I do think the female characters, and there's some good stuff in here, but yeah, they do feel more like accessories.
They're ancillary to the story. They're not central to the story at all. They're not given equal measure and less than equal. I mean, that is an important point about this film that I think is, yeah, very valid.
Because Rosie Perez, the first time we, I mean, aside from the dance scene in the beginning, the first time they had, and again, stereotypes, like we get her yelling at her mom in Spanish and carrying around the kid, like a very typical Hollywood scene of like, this is what, you know, Hispanic women are like, or Puerto Rican, I believe.
Latina women.
Yeah, spicy Latinas. They're just
screaming. reduced to a stereotype. And I have been on the receiving end of the stereotype. There is a person that I know closely who, for myriad reasons, I will not share their name, but they have said that to me a bunch of times. Like, oh, you're just being spicy Latina. And I'm like, and this is one of those things that boils over, right? Like, at what point will I become spicy Latina and snap at him, right? Because it eventually is not funny.
Yeah.
And it's things like, oh, just shut up. You're being spicy Latina. Oh, shut up about that. Like, don't talk to me that way. Don't make me just this one thing. Don't, you know, condense me down to this one stereotype, because it's bullshit.
It's like a fucked up, like, attempt at a self-fulfilling prophecy. That sucks.
Right. You're trying to trigger me into being the thing that you think I am. And I'm trying to be composed, but at some point I'm not going to be composed, and it's going to be because you pushed me there. Right. And that's this whole story. That's this whole story.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, we see her there. We see that scene, which I don't love. And then we don't see her for an hour. And then she's topless within like 3 minutes. It's 1989. I understand it was a different time. Spike Lee's 32 years old. He's come a long way. But like, yeah, that didn't sit super well with me.
No, that whole scene, her whole storyline did not sit well with me. Yeah. I mean, it's the like, he won't come and I can't get attention from him and I can't get him to pay attention to me and my kids. So I'm going to order a pizza to get him here. And I cannot tell you how much that made me itch. I was just like, if he won't come, don't literally pay him to come. Ultimately, that's what just happened, right? So, I mean, I have a lot of problems with that storyline, but I do think the crux of what this film is about is very well done and very important. And so I can kind of, to some degree, move past the things that I think are not well done about it. And that is definitely one of them.
Agreed. So let's get into sort of the climax, and we've talked about the sort of the symbolism of the temperatures rising. Again, an hour and 20 into the film, there's this single shot of sort of the heat waves when Radio Raheem is there, and it's the only one where it's like distorting the visual of just like sort of like a mirage shot. And I'm like, oh, that's very telling, because we're seeing things get more and more intense. I think I lost like a pound of water weight watching this movie. Mm-hmm. So it's like sympathy pain. But like, it's just this perfect powder keg of a film, and it lures you in, I feel like, by getting you, like I've said, not comfortable, but just like, oh, is this okay? Am I allowed to laugh at this? Like, this is kind of inappropriate. And then at the end, you get this lesson of like what this has all been building to. And I think it's a genius piece of filmmaking. But where do you want to start on sort of the conclusion?
Yeah, I don't think we need to, again, like, I hope people have watched this by now. And I obviously, if you're still listening, I assume you have. So I don't think we need to belabor what happens. But the crux of the matter is that Buggin' Out's, you know, basically boycotting of Sal's all day, or attempting to, has come to a head. People are angry. They go in, and it's telling to me that it starts with, again, this balance of somebody trying to do something nice and then it boiling over, which is that if Sal had never opened the door to the pizzeria to let them in and have a late night pizza, even though they're closed, these tensions wouldn't have escalated and resulted in it literally being burned to the ground, Radio Raheem dying by the cops' hands deliberately, and the riots that then ensue, right? Yeah. So none of that would have happened if he hadn't been like, oh, I love these kids, let them in, you know, I'm going to make, they want my pizza. They love my pizza. And I think that's so telling in and of itself, but that he boils over as well. And I think that's, we've touched on it throughout. That's what happens over and over, is these one more comment, one more thing, you pick one more fight. And then what's important to understand is that, again, he's just closed his restaurant to you guys. He's done for the night. He's been busting his ass all day. It's hot as shit. He's in front of a hot pizza oven. He comes in to do you guys a solid, and he wants, y'all want to get fed. He makes you a pizza, and then you come in picking a fight, right? Not those kids, but somebody else does, right? So then he's triggered by that. But then they are being aggressive and picking a fight at the wrong time and saying all these racist things themselves. And then his racist son is participating, and it just, it's one thing after another, and it piles on. Right. And the way that it explodes, again, so understandable, so realistic, it so makes sense, but it is nothing short of devastating. And you do not get spared at all the death of Radio Raheem. You see it vividly in detail, and it's all the things that we have heard since then. And I think that's why this is so poignant of a film now, of it's the, he can't breathe, let him go. Yeah. He's not resisting. Like, you hear all these things that are the fucking theme song to this bullshit that are still true to this day. And it's enraging, and it's devastating, and it's predictable. That's the hard part. It's, you know exactly what's going to happen as soon as it starts to happen.
Yep. It's, yeah. Unfortunately, like, tale as old as time in America. But, like, I think I've used the word perspective multiple times on this podcast. And that's what I kept coming back to, of, I feel like the way this plays out is a very, like, well, what did you see? Like, through your own experience and your perspective, what did you see happen here? And I think your race factors in, I think your gender factors in, I think a lot of things factor into this. Because honestly, throughout this film, I was like, Radio Raheem's kind of fucking annoying. Like, I would be annoyed. I mean, he's walking around with a boombox, going into businesses. Like, why do you feel the need to do that? Yeah. So it's like, but I'm not making light of what happens to him in any way, but I think that is getting you to sort of self-examine of, like, just because he did this, just because you does not deserve anything else. And it was like, just because he is playing the boombox, should Sal have destroyed
beaten the shit out of it with a bat?
Because Sal did that, should Radio Raheem have attacked him? No.
Right.
Because he did that, should the cops have come and killed him? Absolutely not. Because the cops killed him, should Sal's place have gotten trashed? It's like, none of this makes logical sense, but when tensions are high and people's emotions overflow, this is the way that it seems to go.
But everybody snapped is the point. Mm-hmm. Everybody snapped at the same time. Everybody's buttons were pushed at the right moment, at the right time, in the right way. Even Smiley, the kid who is referred to multiple times by the R word, but obviously just has some sort of disability in some way, is enraged. And this is a person that, like, I feel like you look at him as kind of a positive light most of the time, even though, even when he's not being treated well, he's the same kind soul, sweet soul throughout this film. And even he at this point is angry. You know, and I think that is very telling, that everyone is angry. Everyone has snapped. Everyone is boiling over. He's sobbing at one point. Ella's not sobbing. They have killed Radio Raheem. Like, at that point, you've seen somebody that you love die. And it is not, I love the quote that they call it at the end, the Martin Luther King Jr. quote, as well as the Malcolm X quote. But he calls out, like, an eye for an eye leaves the whole world blind, and, like, we can't lead this way. And all of that is true. But when you're already in a heightened state and you just saw somebody that you love get murdered, what would you do? And I think that's the, like, that's the perspective that everybody, does need from this film, is, like, you are not immune to this moment. No one is immune to this moment. In the right circumstances, under the right pressure, in the right situation, and somebody you love being involved, this can happen, you know, and it's devastating for everyone involved.
Yeah, it is complex as fuck. And they have some lines of dialogue there that explain that. Somebody says, Sal didn't have anything to do with the cops. Why are you going to try it? Why are you wanting to attack him? I think Smiley says one of the cops was black. And it's like, this is a complex fucking issue. Yeah. Like, then somebody else says he just died because he had a radio. That doesn't mean you deserve to die. All this, it just doesn't hide the ugliness of the issue. I mean, it's a fucked up thing to say, but it's like the trashing of the pizzeria, the looting that happens, the way that it spills over to the Koreans who had nothing to do with this. And I thought that that was the natural way it would play out, too, of like, yeah, let's go this other business that we don't feel fits in this neighborhood. I expected that to happen, too. And it's like, none of this is right.
I think that's a good call out, though, because that ends up stopping to some degree. Like, it doesn't escalate the way it does at Sal's. And it's because the Korean shop owner says, you and I are the same. We are in the same situation. We are both different. We are both other here. And it's this weird moment that calms people and they realize that that is in some degree true. And I think that's the beginning of the lightening of tensions in that moment. And what I thought was so interesting about him as a shop owner is that these people have been racist to him. These people have not welcomed him. And he sees Radio Raheem die and be murdered and something snaps in him. And he is angry. He is enraged. He's part of the mob. He's beating the police car. He's going like, I see him. He is dead. You killed him. He's acknowledging it with them. And I think
I must miss that. That's interesting.
I think to some degree that is the beginning of an understanding for them. And I think that's why Spike Lee has been quoted as saying, I think this movie ends on hope. Like it ends on this hope that we will begin to understand one another as a result of this perspective, having this perspective of one another. And you see that even Mookie and Sal reach this uneasy peace at the end. They are not reconciled. Mm-hmm. They are not going to be friends again. This has changed everything. But they, to some degree, understand how each other got here and why this happened. And nobody's forgiving anyone. They're just acknowledging the way that it is and understanding how it happened. And I think that's the little bit of hope that you get at the end of that. The next day in the hangover of this horror, you're not in the same state. Yeah. You're not in the same state of rage. You're not in the same state of anger only. You're beginning to try and look at it and understand what happened. And even Mr. Senior Love Daddy's commentary is similar of like, we got to keep moving forward. You know, he's the narrator of like, the mayor has committed to figuring out what happened last night and there should be no violence on these streets. And you see people beginning their day the same way that they have every other day, which is both beautiful and horrifying. Right? Because someone in their community was just murdered and they have to just keep living. Yeah. They have to just keep going about their day as after this injustice. And it's resilient and beautiful. And it's terrible that they've had to become that resilient to something like this.
Yeah. I guess last thing I'll say is just that last conversation. I love the way that it plays out. It's this, like you said, uneasy, but it's like, hate and love are not black and white issues as far as like morality. And so it's like, I don't think that Sal and Mookie hate each other in that moment. They may have, but it's like, they don't need to love each other, but just there's a line of like respect and acceptance and trying to get along despite what we've said throughout this of we all have underlying things based on our experiences that make us more defensive or whatever you might say. But you mentioned the Martin Luther King Jr. quote, and I love how it's immediately followed by the Malcolm X quote, because I think that is Spike Lee giving you sort of two perspectives. Because I read that first one and I was like, I don't agree with that. Honestly, like just to me, just saying I'm going to continue to be beaten down and never violently react in any way, I guess that's just never made sense to me. I understand the logic from MLK, but I thought the Malcolm X quote, I was glad that he included that and gave those two perspectives and leaves it up to you to make up your own mind.
Yeah, again, I think it's all about perspective. And I think those are two very valid perspectives. And Malcolm X saw his approach to racial tensions and inequality in one way, and MLK Jr. saw it in another way, right? They both saw their perspectives as valid from different points of view and different life's experiences. And, you know, Malcolm X is often attributed as being the quote unquote violent movement of mm-hmm. the civil rights movement. And he didn't see it that way. He saw it as self-defense. And I think it's important yep. to call that quote out of there is a point at which it is no longer it's no longer violence and it's no longer nonviolence. It is, there's a line where it becomes self-defense. And it's, and I think that's what Spike Lee's trying to show us of, I have to defend this community against this becoming our reality, this becoming our lives, this becoming the way we're treated and subjugated forever. That can't be allowed to stand. And sometimes that can boil over. And I think it's, it makes a lot of sense. Yeah. I also wanted to share one quote from the Roger Ebert article, which Spike Lee called out as being one of the best criticisms of the film he thought. Like, he does not give a roadmap to this film for context, folks. Mm-hmm. If you don't know this already, he does not tell you what it means. He's not telling you what you're supposed to think. And so there's been a lot of conflicting criticism that has come out of this film. And one of the things that Roger Ebert said in the closing of one of his articles I thought was really well done, which was, I believe that any good-hearted person, white or black, will come out of this movie with sympathy for all of the characters. Lee does not ask us to forgive them or even to understand everything they do, but he wants us to identify with their fears and frustrations. Do the Right Thing doesn't ask its audience to choose sides. It is scrupulously fair to both sides in a story where it is our society itself that is not fair. And I just thought that was kind of the mic drop on it for me personally.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. I know that the production companies wanted a quote-unquote happier ending. They wanted Sal and Mookie to reconcile. And he's like, no, that is not the bullshit. Point of this story. That is some Hollywood bullshit. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, just, I mean, I want to end. I think that this was so like, good. So good and so great to talk about. If for some reason you made it here, go watch this. This is actually number 96 on the American Film Institute's top 100 movies of all time. Mm-hmm. So absolutely worth seeing. We've only done one other movie from that list. Do you know which one it is?
No. Well, not off the top of my head. I'm sure I could look at our list and think of it, but I don't even remember everything we've done at this point. Right. Which one?
It was Pulp Fiction. So that's like two spots ahead of this one is Pulp Fiction. You get another Sam Jackson on there. So good for him. But
he's the glue. He's the glue.
He's the glue that holds it all together. But yeah, and then the last little, I hesitate to use the word fun fact, but you know, the little neat thing is that this was actually the first movie that the Obamas went to see on their first date. So that's
so fucking on brand, by the way.
And I don't mean,
I don't mean because it's a black film. I mean, because of like the social justice of it all. It's so on brand and I love that. All right. Well, we talked about this movie quite a bit. I think it's clear we both really enjoyed it and think it's very important. What is your rating?
Whew. I'm gonna give it like a 9. I think it's incredible. I think it's important. There's some uncomfortable things about it, but I don't think that makes it bad. I think it's just like you're gonna have some rough spots in here, and I think that it loses a little bit because of the use of Rosie Perez and a couple of the other critiques I had, but I think it's something everybody should see.
Yeah, I gave it a 9 for very similar reasons. I take off a little bit for some of the things that would improve as he grows as a filmmaker, basically, you know, but the story itself is rock solid and very important. And I'm really glad that we did this. So thank you guys for joining us. Appreciate you hanging in for this one. It's a long one, but I think a worthy one.
Yeah.
Come back next week as we continue our Juneteenth celebrations with Black filmmakers, directors, actors, writers, etc. And we're going to do what we think is an iconic one, maybe seemingly low-hanging fruit, but it's iconic for a reason, which is Black Panther. So come back.
Right. Like the logic there is, hey, not to say that Black Panther does not have some issues that it speaks to as well, but it's like, oh, this was heavy. Maybe we should do like a Marvel film. So that's the logic.
Also, this is a celebratory month, right? Like we don't want it to all be heavy. We're not going to avoid that topic, but we're going to also celebrate the joyful moments as well. And I think Black Panther delivers a lot of joyful moments, both in and outside of the film for Black filmmakers. So really excited to do that one. So, but for now, go have a drink and watch a thing. Cheers.
Cheers.